May peace be with you. If you stick around at the end, there's more information about our community and how to find us. And now, here's this week's Centering Scripture, followed by the sermon.
Today our scripture comes from Leviticus 25, 18 through 19, and 23 through 24, and Numbers 35, 33 through 34. From Leviticus. You shall observe my statutes and faithfully keep my ordinances, so that you may live on the land securely. The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live on it securely. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land. And from Numbers, you shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land. And no expiation, which means atonement, can be made for the land for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in which I also dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the Israelites.
In a moment, I'm going to introduce Chris Wells, who's going to be speaking with us today. But I wanted to point out a couple things about the scripture lessons that I chose. Not Chris, I chose them, so I bear the blame. But I think it's important that one of the things, there's lots of ways of thinking about caring for the earth and what it means to be human. And one of the things that's clear in scripture is the notion of ownership that we have, which is kind of like, I own this thing in perpetuity and I will benefit from it, is not scriptural. It acknowledges that land should eventually be returned in the year of the Jubilee, be redistributed. It also realizes that what happens on one piece of land affects the land around it. And you know, over time, land tends to accumulate to those who have, right? And the things that happen on it may hurt those who live on it, but often hurt those who depend on it more than those who own it. So this thing that I'm not describing very well that Chris will describe much better is often called environmental justice. And it's deeply rooted in scripture and in our faith. Chris, whose kids are friends with my daughter Adelaide and who we've hung out a lot with, we were pod mates during COVID together. So we saw a lot of each other and each other's children. Dr. Wells' research is teaching is focused on ways that technology and systems have reshaped the American environment. If you ever want to read a really interesting book, you can read Car Country, which is an environmental history of the automobile. It is fascinating. And he's also worked on several anthologies and collections of primary sources from post-war about environmental justice in the whole nation and also in particular, in Minnesota. So without any more introduction, Chris Wells.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for having me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here, especially not only on approximate to Earth Day, but on a beautiful sunny day as well. And to think about ideas like justice and equality and care for God's creation. The history of environmental injustice, which we just heard about, runs long and deep. But the birth of what we'd call the modern environmental justice movement can really be dated precisely to September 15th, 1982. On that morning, a group of 130 dedicated protesters, black and white, young and old, set out on a march in Warren County, North Carolina. Their destination was a brand new toxic waste landfill, the first in the state, set to open that morning, which was about to begin to receive truckload after truckload after truckload of soil laced with cancer-causing PCB chemicals. The protesters had fought for years to try to prevent the landfill from opening to no avail. And so, in an act of moral witness and nonviolent resistance, they lay down in the middle of the road, blocking the path of the dump trucks. Over the following weeks, the protests grew, and before it was all over, more than 500 people had been arrested. The images from that day were striking. You may even have seen them. And they looked more like scenes from the civil rights movement than from a typical environmental protest of the 1970s. Photographs taken that day capture black and white demonstrators locked arm in arm, singing and praying, as police with billy clubs and visored helmets lined up behind them. The pictures show protesters lying at neatly arranged intervals in the middle of a tree-lined rural highway in front of a long line of dump trucks stretching off into the distance. They show protesters carrying signs, duct taped to sticks, some held high above a parade of marchers, others weary protesters standing by the side of the road, signs resting on their shoulders. One shows a young black girl, maybe 10 years old, wearing neat pigtails and a ruffled shirt with a flower print, with a giant cardboard sign tucked under her arm, reading, "We're trying to stop PCB before PCB stops us." And of course, there's photo after photo after photo of police officers carrying limp protesters, one by one, towards a line of yellow school buses, which had been adapted as makeshift paddy wagons. Underscoring the extent to which this represented something other than traditional environmental activism, none of the people arrested in Warren County in those days held leadership in national environmental organizations. But prominent leaders from the civil rights movement populated the lists of those arrested, including the Reverend Joseph Lowery, who was the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had founded after the successful boycott of buses in Montgomery, Alabama. Reverend Benjamin Chavis, who was deputy director of the United Church of Christ's Commission for Racial Justice, and the DC congressional delegate, Walter Fauntleroy, who'd helped coordinate the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his famous "I Have a Dream" speech at the Lincoln Memorial. The Warren County protests marked a turning point. They were the coming out party for a new movement, one that insisted that environmentalism and civil rights were inseparable. As one protester that day put it, "They didn't expect us to organize, but we're gonna fight. It's one thing to be poor, it's another to be poor and poisoned." Yet the new movement was also a direct challenge to the leadership and priorities of mainstream environmental organizations. These new advocates for environmental justice argued, in fact, that the mainstream environmental movement had, for a couple of decades, ignored the plight of communities of color and the poor. Environmental justice activists contended that though mainstream environmentalism had pursued policies that made the environment much cleaner for most Americans, those same policies did little to confront the reality that those who lived on the margins consistently had to live with the worst toxic threats. At best, environmentalists had neglected those unequal burdens. At worst, the solutions they'd carried out had actually made them worse. So the story behind the dump trucks laced with contaminated soil lined up behind those protesters on the tree-lined highway in 1982 helps to underscore what they were talking about. The story of how those PCBs ended up in the trucks had begun 4 years earlier in 1978 when a man named Robert Ward, the owner of the Ward Transformer Company, conspired with a friend, Robert Burns, to illegally dispose of insulating oil containing PCBs that Ward's company had drained from old electrical transformers. To avoid the high costs of proper disposal required under new toxic substance regulations, Burns and his sons conducted a whole host of midnight dumping runs, during which they sprayed some 31,000 gallons of the PCB-based laced oil along more than 200 miles of rural highways across 14 counties. 200 miles. Now, when the illegal dumping was discovered, state officials did exactly as they should have and as were required by law, and they cleaned it up. But the state did not have a licensed toxic waste facility, so regulators got to work trying to figure out where they could build one. Rather than incorporating public input into the process, however, which was required for hazardous waste facilities, which is a legal distinction from those things like PCBs categorized as toxic waste, the state made the decision to site the facility in Warren County. I'm sorry, I missed a line. They were regulated differently and did not require public participation. And so the state secretly made the decision to site the facility in Warren County, which was the poorest, blackest county in the state. Residents were blindsided when they learned not only that a toxic waste dump was coming to their community, but also that PCBs scraped from 200 miles of highway were already waiting to be deposited there. Despite their vigorous opposition and well-founded concerns that the landfill would leach harmful chemicals into local groundwater, the courts allowed the landfill to open, setting the stage for the dramatic protests with which I opened. What transformed this struggle from a single protest to a full-blown movement, however, was the slow accumulation of evidence that the situation in Warren County was not an isolated incident. That in fact, the pattern repeated itself all over the country, and that environmental regulations consistently benefited whiter and wealthier areas, and with similar consistency, either failed to improve, or sometimes made worse, the environmental conditions of the poorest and most marginalized neighborhoods. In 1987, for example, the groundbreaking report, Toxic Wastes and Race in the United States, by the United Church of Christ, found that race was the most significant factor in determining the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities. The study revealed that 3 out of every 5 Black and Hispanic Americans lived in communities with uncontrolled toxic waste sites, and that the percentage of minorities in communities with the largest number of hazardous waste facilities was 3 times greater than in communities without such facilities. The truth was, the pattern of concentrating polluting industries and hazardous facilities in communities of color wasn't new. In fact, it had deep roots in the long history of racial segregation in the United States. In the decades stretching from the 1870s to the 1920s, the era of rapid industrialization and urbanization in this country, segregationist policies and practices funneled minority populations into urban ghettos characterized by overcrowding, inferior housing, and pollution. In the 1920s and 1930s, racially restrictive covenants, redlining, and other forms of housing discrimination ensured that even as cities grew, people of color remained concentrated in those neglected and polluted neighborhoods. These segregationist patterns persisted and intensified in the decades following World War II. As the nation's economy boomed, many dirty industries abandoned the core of the city for more spacious suburban locations, but they usually didn't take their pollution with them. Instead, contaminated industrial sites and other locally undesirable land uses became even more heavily concentrated in neighborhoods where people of color lived. Places like West Dallas in Texas, Cancer Alley in Louisiana, and the South Side of Chicago. At the same time, the economic benefits of the post-war boom flowed disproportionately to white Americans, enabling them to flee the inner cities for greener pastures in the suburbs, leaving communities of color to bear the brunt of the urban environmental burden. Now, as environmental justice advocates told these stories and worked to get their concerns onto the national agenda in the 1980s and 1990s, they came into direct conflict with the EPA and mainstream environmentalists. In debating how to clean up the toxic contamination in Warren County, for example, environmental justice advocates and environmental regulators couldn't even agree on what the real environmental problem that they were trying to solve really was. For the EPA, the obvious problem was the PCBs, which had been illegally dumped on the roadsides and were a serious threat to the entire state. The solution was to scrape them up and put them in a landfill. But for Warren County activists, the problem was the decision to locate a toxic landfill in their backyard, and in doing so to waive key siting criteria designed to safeguard the placement of such landfills where they might leach into the groundwater. As they saw it, the real threat to their environment came not from the original polluters, but from the very officials who claimed to be solving the problems. And here I'll note, the protesters turned out to be more prescient than the regulators in this particular case. This landfill became a Superfund site soon thereafter, after it was discovered that it was in fact leaching those chemicals into the local water supply. Environmental justice leaders also took mainstream environmentalists to task for relying so heavily on scientific experts and technological fixes. Many of these experts didn't even live in the affected communities, but nonetheless, they were the ones who got to decide what level of contamination was safe for local residents to live with. And all too often, environmental justice advocates noted, officials seemed willing to cut corners, waiving key safety criteria and putting their faith in unproven, untested technologies. And they did so much more often when the risks would be borne by poor communities and communities of color than in others. In calling out these injustices, the environmental justice movement represented an act of speaking truth to power, a cry for justice in the face of a system that placed too little value in the lives of the poor and the marginalized. By putting their bodies on the line, testifying to the sacred worth of every human being and the right of all people to a clean and healthy environment, they were embodying the words of the prophet Amos, quoted frequently in both the civil rights movement and the environmental justice movement, who declared, "Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." So as we gather today to worship together and celebrate Earth Day, let us give thanks for the courage and moral conviction of the Warren County protesters and others who follow in their footsteps. Let us remember that the call to care for creation is also a call to care for our fellow human beings, especially the poor and the vulnerable. Let us recommit ourselves to the hard work of building a society of love and justice, where the blessings of clean air, pure water, and healthy neighborhoods are not just a privilege for some, but a fundamental right for all. And in the end, I think that's really the moral to my story, that fighting for environmental justice is an integral part of what it means to love our neighbors as ourselves. It's about recognizing that the struggle to protect the environment and the struggle for social justice are inextricably linked. It's about understanding that we can't heal and protect the planet without also working to heal the injustices and inequities that divide the human family. It's about embracing our calling as people of faith to be good stewards of all that is entrusted to our care, the earth and each other. May we have the wisdom, the courage, and the perseverance to answer that call.
As a church located on Lakota land in Minnetonka, Minnesota, St. Luke is a joyful, inclusive, intergenerational, and compassionate community on a spiritual journey seeking to do justice, make peace, and to walk humbly with God. We invite you to join us live for virtual worship each Sunday morning on Facebook or YouTube, or by following the worship links on our website, stluke.mn. Thanks for listening. May you go in peace.